I'm going to talk tonight about a sutta called the Water Snake Sutta, which is an amazing teaching by the Buddha. And it sort of is one of those teachings that sort of encapsulates so much of the entire Dhamma within it. And when you read it or when you hear it, you walk away with a lot of insight into what Buddhism is and what makes Buddhism different from virtually every other, well, from every other spiritual path. Buddhism has its own core teachings which separate it from Hinduism and other spiritual paths. And I think it's really summarized in this teaching. Certainly there is no other spiritual path where you would hear the water snake, what the Buddha teaches. In it. As a way of opening remarks, just a couple of things to bear in mind. The first thing is that the core of Buddha's teaching is, of course, karma, which basically summarized is that when we act out of harmfulness or craving, we tend to bring about long-term suffering for ourselves and other beings. And when we act out of harmlessness, generosity, compassion, renouncing the things we crave, we tend to bring about long-term peace of mind. So there's a direct correlation between the quality of our thoughts and our actions and the amount of happiness. In fact, while there are, of course, in life some forms of suffering that are caused by other beings, we, by and large, are the authors of most of our suffering. And we have also the tools at our disposal to end our stress and suffering. That's the good news. Bad news, of course, is that it takes work. It's not that easy. We have to pay attention. We have to let go of things that bring about short-term, easy, fun, quick results in favor of things that in the short term don't feel that good, but in the long term bring us great peace of mind and self-esteem. For example, smoking crack probably feels great in the short term. It's been years since I smoked cocaine, so I can't really comment on it. Maybe they've got better cocaine, but I'm still pretty certain that the results are short term. The short term results of meditation. Meditation, when you're learning it, really doesn't feel that fun. In fact, you settle into your body and you're like, holy shit, this is hard. What the fuck have I done? Why aren't I doing something fun like watching TV? Instead, I'm sitting here with my eyes closed, breathing. I must look retarded. So that is the example of something that in the short term doesn't bring a lot of fun, but in the long term, the benefits of meditation are many. Not only are there lots of documented positive results by the American Medical Association from reduction in stress, hypertension, reduction in cancer and strokes. You can reduce the amount of heart attacks. You can reduce the amount of cortisol flowing in your body. You can actually reduce or slow down the aging process. Not that we will all age, sicken, and die. Meditation will not stop that, but you can actually increase the long-term quality of your life. But on top of that, too, you can reduce the amount of stress and also increase the amount of mindfulness that you have in your day-to-day life so that most of our thoughts and our actions are not simply dictated out of habit or fear, but actually come about through a process of thoughtfulness and have a foundation in wisdom. So the benefits, the long-term benefits of meditation are many and great. But of course, the immediate effects are not that visible. On the other hand, an example of something that feels great in the short term, lots of people, when they feel lonely, like to run out to a bar and have sex with the first person they can talk into having sex with. And that's probably great for a while if you can do it. I was never too good at that. I'm a neurotic guy. Whatever. But there are people I would watch who were terrific at that. But The long-term results, generally, of having to have sex every time you feel stressed out or lonely, probably, in fact, I can guarantee you, they're not that good. However, for example, the long-term results of exercising. The first time you exercise and you lift some weights, if you stand in front of a mirror and you look at yourself, you will not notice any change, I guarantee you. You would pretty much be asinine if after your first exercise and you lifted a couple of weights, you stood in front of the mirror and got disappointed. Because you know that that is not the way exercise works. Exercise generally requires things called repetition and doing it lots of times over a long period of time. Then you see the many positive results. Increased muscle strength, cardiovascular health, blah, blah, blah. So you get the idea. There are things that feel good in the short term, but in the long term bring about suffering and stress. And there are things that feel sort of boring or lousy in the short term or not that fun. But in the long term, they bring peace of mind, a sense of relaxation, calm, happiness. And the Buddha said the difference between the wise and the foolish was simply this, that they could tell the difference between things that are good for them in the long term and things that were not good in the long term. They had an ability to focus on the long term, not just see the short term result. That's what the difference between the wise and the foolish are. So that brings us up to today's sutta. There was many years ago a young monk under the Buddha's and the Buddha's followers named Arita. And Arita probably was pretty jealous of the fact that before Buddhism, when Brahmanism was the hit and the rage throughout India, the Brahmins believed that the only people who had any chance of real spiritual happiness were monks, and everybody else was basically screwed. There was a big divide in Brahmanism between the religious monks, the Brahmins who were in possession of spiritual knowledge, and everybody else. You were a householder or a lay practitioner, you were basically under Brahmanism, basically told to do a lot of animal sacrifices and to follow what the Brahmins taught, but you really had very little insight into the true nature of things, and you'd be very lucky to achieve any lasting happiness. Now, the Buddha came along and he taught something very different. He taught that people, normal people, householders, even the lowest of castes could actually achieve lasting happiness because it's all a result of our actions. He, in fact, said that householders could be what's known as stream enters, which means they actually could reduce greatly the amount of suffering and actually experience for a period of time, a short period of time, but definitely could experience glimpses of nirvana or enlightenment. They could actually get great spiritual results. So this new monk, it seems, Arita, was not very happy about this and, felt obviously somewhat disappointed that the great advantages of being a monk, he thought, were diminished by the Buddhist teachings. And so there arose in him a pernicious view. Now, a pernicious view is not just a wrong view, like we can have wrong views all the time, but a pernicious view means you're really in trouble, you're fucked. You're thinking something or teaching something that is a direct threat, to immediate threat to your happiness, to the happiness of those around you, and it's to be taken very seriously. And basically what his view was that he said that what the things that the Buddha said that were not good for our enlightenment, like avoiding craving, avoiding hatred, avoiding ignorance, he said those obstructions that the Buddha says are bad for us, that's not true. It's not true. The Buddha's exaggerating. And really, if you study this sutta and you go into the backdrop, what's really going on is Arita wanted to get laid. He thought that it was unfair that householders could achieve stream entry. So he basically was saying, this is a very coded way of saying back then, that the obstructions of of sex that the Buddha talked about for monastics was not true, and basically if he acted out on his cravings, he could still wind up achieving the highest forms of enlightenment. So the other monks talked to him, and they were unable to dissuade him of saying that the Buddha was exaggerating. So finally, Arita was brought before the Buddha. The Buddha never believed anything that was told to him by hearsay. He would always, in all the suttas, ask the monk without any forcing, would just say, could you repeat to me what your understanding is? And the monk, Arita, said, it's my understanding that what you say is bad for us. It's craving, hatred, and ignorance is not, in fact, bad for us. And then the Buddha basically lit into him. And it's very rare for the Buddha to verbally take on anybody. There's only a few times throughout all the suttas where you really see the Buddha lay into somebody. But in this one sutta, the Buddha calls him an outright fool and a stupid man. He says, you stupid man, you totally don't understand anything I've taught. And then he goes on to say that, you know, that of course, that when we cling and crave short-term happiness through sensual pleasures, and he's especially talking right now about monks, it gets in the way of their long-term lasting enlightenment. Now, he's not saying that we can't have sex in our lives and not achieve moments or periods of enlightenment, but certainly if you are during a meditation craving having sex with the person sitting next to you, you will not drop into nirvana. It's just not going to happen. You're going to have to let go of that craving in order to get anywhere. Lust is not a bedfellow of lasting peace of mind. It's agitating. Now, that's not to say that, again, people can have sex and achieve moments of great release and nibbana, but they generally can't have it at the same time. And the Buddha is certainly saying that the point of monks, which is to achieve lasting enlightenment, that what Arita is teaching is incorrect. Now, this is all like an opening for the Buddha to give two of the most famous analogies in his teachings, and they're really wonderful, and they're worth thinking about, and if you want to read it, it's online. There are many, many translations of it. The Buddha first gives an analogy of the water snake. In ancient India, the venom of the water snake was considered to be a great medicine that could cure people of diseases and cure people of things that ailed them. The problem with the venom is that it's also very poisonous if you are bitten by the snake. So people who would simply try to grab onto a water snake to get their venom would often be bit and die. There was only one way to safely hold the water snake and to get the venom from it so that they could put it in a bottle and then dilute it and then use it as a medicine. In case you're interested, in fact, the way is to get a stick to hold it on the snake's neck so that near its head so that it's disabled, grab it by its head so that it couldn't bite you, and then it would release its venom and somebody else would catch the venom into a jar. Now, the metaphor the Buddha's using here is the snake, in a certain sense here, is a metaphor for the fact that, or catching the snake, is a metaphor in a sense for that certain things in life are difficult, but they give long-term good results. If you simply try to grab the snake willy-nilly without any training, without any practice, and just try to get the benefits from it, you'll wind up getting bitten. You'll wind up using the Dhamma incorrectly. The way the Buddha says to use the Dhamma correctly, he says, is to sit and practice and see if it's true, to listen to what he's saying, and then to put it into practice. Don't believe him. See if what he's teaching is true in your own experience. The wrong way, he says, to approach or grasp onto the Dhamma is to use or learn what he's teaching simply to beat up other people intellectually or to show off. So that's incorrect grasping of a water snake. It's simply learning the Dhamma as an intellectual exercise. It's something, hey, guess what? I learned Buddhism this week. Want to hear about it? And look, we all do this to a certain extent. When I was 23, many, many years ago, I used to run around and was basically a pompous twat about all this stuff. So I have to say that don't feel embarrassed if at any point in your interest in Buddhism you started out by grasping the water snake the wrong way. We all do. But the long-term point is to eventually let go of any social hipness that Buddhism might bring, any sense of superiority or great insight, and simply to use it in our own life to see what clarity it brings about our own actions and how we're causing our own stress and suffering. See if thoughts of worrying what other people think about us or worrying about what's going to happen to us in the future, if these thoughts bring long-term happiness or if these thoughts bring stress. Watch them. See what happens. Put it under the test. Don't believe the Buddha. Don't believe me. Test it out for yourself. Okay? That's what the correct way to handle the water snake is. So, the Buddha then goes on. The entire theme of this sutta is about grasping. And so he says, just like we have to learn how to grasp the water snake correctly, I'm going to give you another example. And he moves on to a second famous analogy called the raft. The Buddha says there are times when a traveler finds himself on a shoreline that is rocky and dangerous and filled with pernicious creatures and, you know, other dangers. And he looks across a very expansive body of water that can't be swum across. And he sees a shore that is safe and idyllic and a place where one would want to reside. And the Buddha says, there might not be any vehicle to get across this water. So what one would do in this instance is to look around and find bits and pieces of wood and other things and to fashion together a raft. And once the raft is used to cross this body of water to the safe shore, he said one might be tempted to carry around the raft as they walked around the safe shore, thinking, wow, this raft was really helpful. I better not let it go. I better drag this raft with me everywhere I go. Maybe I'll run to another shore. Buddha says this is incorrect, that the entire point is to know when to use the raft and when to let it go. Now, this analogy is obviously an analogy about his teachings. The Buddha is saying, rather than carry around what he teaches and use it like this heavy weight where you're carrying around all the time, that's not the way to carry the Dhamma. The way, in fact, is to use it like a raft to get across the shore. But then when you get across the shore, when you get to a place where you're peaceful, when you're relaxed, when you're calm, when you're tranquil, to put it down. You see, not to drag it around with you. In this example, there's many times the Buddha uses this analogy, and the analogy is always the same. This shore is the shore of suffering, of samsara, as it's called, and the distant shore is what's known as nibbana or enlightenment. And the raft is an analogy for the Eightfold Path, the Four Noble Truths, the teachings of karma. So the idea is, in life, when we are in stress and suffering, that's when we recollect one of the teachings as a raft, see if it will get us across to a place of tranquility and calm, when we're there, to put it down. But not to then continue to think and recite or tell or talk about or then carry the Dhamma around with us. It's not something that we want to memorize and constantly be carrying around when we found a place of peace. The Dhamma, and this is one of the Buddha's most memorable statements about it, the Dhamma is for the ending of all views, biases, inclinations, obsessions, even the Dhamma itself. It is for the stilling of fabrications. Fabrications mean adding on to what's ever going on right now. Whenever we fabricate, it's that need to bring something else to life that's not there. It is for the relinquishing of the things that we've acquired. It's for the letting go. It's for the ending of suffering. It's truly remarkable teaching. I really can't imagine any other great spiritual figure, be it Moses or Jesus or Muhammad, as great as these figures were, I can't imagine them saying, by the way, you don't have to carry around my teachings all the time. Learn when to put them down and forget about them. And by the way, don't believe what I'm saying. Test them out. If all the spiritual teachers had had that one little clause in there, I personally think the world would have been a less fucked up place at times than it's been. That's my personal opinion. Can somebody just slightly turn on the light a little bit? We're descending into an almost cave-like. That's perfect. Romantic even, yes. Come with me as I lead you through the soothing Dharma, while my assistant will be reaching through your wallets. So, concluding with this, then the Buddha reaches the final part of the sutta, which is my favorite part, and this is where we really get to the part that separates Buddhism from every other single practice. Continuing the thoughts on grasping and clinging and how we hold on to things, the Buddha says, remember those things I taught you about called the aggregates, what you consider to be yourself, namely your thoughts, your feelings, your body sensations, your perceptions, your consciousness. Remember those? None of those are who you are. None of those are yourself. None of those you should cling on to. You should experience all your feelings, all your thoughts, all your perceptions, everything that arises in you. You should not take it personally, not take any of it as yourself. In fact, he says that we start clinging the moment we think three things. This is mine, this is what I am, and this is myself. The moment we start thinking those things, this is who I am, these thoughts, these are who I am, these feelings, this is really who I am, these gut feelings are myself. The moment we start constructing a personality, a lasting personality or identity from these aggregates, is the moment we start clinging and clasping and grasping and attaching, and that's where stress and suffering begins. The Buddha then in the sutta goes on to say that the scissors that cut away for our suffering is thinking the thoughts, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not who I am. Whenever we experience anything, just start from that foundation. Whatever thoughts, whatever perceptions, feelings are rising, if you simply think, okay, I'm feeling these feelings, I'm thinking these thoughts, but I don't own them. They're not who I am, they're not my lasting identity, they're just stuff that's happening in my mind right now. I don't have to claim ownership of them. The Buddha and many other suttas uses examples of this where he says no matter really what happens to you in life, everybody has gone through a version of it. If you experience death or loss or not getting what you want or frustration, everybody else experiences that too. Nothing we experience, nothing we think, nothing we go through is personal. And if we start approaching our experience without taking it that personally, it's just experiencing what happens to us as, okay, this is what life is. This is the nature of life. This is what happens in life. In life, frustrating things happen. In life, good things happen. In life, things that are shitty happen. You get the idea. If we start experiencing life this way and the things that arise in us this way, it changes entirely the approach to the way we live. And the Buddha concludes this remarkable sutta It's called, by the way, the Alugadupama. Is that what it is? Oh, my God, have I forgotten the name of it? Yeah, the Alugadupama Sutta, the 22nd Sutta. He concludes by saying, not only are these aggregates, our feelings, our thoughts, our perceptions, not only are these things not who we are, but he goes on one step further. The Buddha, in all his wisdom, anticipates hippies 2,500 years after his time. And he says, if you think you are the cosmos, you're not. You're not the cosmos. There is no cosmological self out there that you should ping into with your spiritual radar. He says, that's not who you are. He says, you're not everything in the universe. There is no universal consciousness. That's not who you are either. At the end of the day, the Buddha is saying, let go of this idea that there's something that we can point to and say, that's me. That's who I am. That very act of needing to have something that I can point to and I can say, man, that's really who I am. That's my core. That's really what I am. The Buddha says, rather than bringing clarity, rather than bringing insight, rather than bringing self-knowledge, this need to incessantly point to something and say, that's my true nature, this is actually the foundation of our stress and suffering. It's truly a remarkable, amazing statement that no other spiritual figure has ever uttered. And it separates Buddhism from every other single spiritual path. The belief that at the end of the day, anatta, which I have tattooed on my left hand, states that there is nothing we can point to that gives us a transcendental or a lasting identity. Sure, at this moment in time, we all have an identity in the sense that we all have a sensation of what we are and who we are and what we're thinking. But the idea that we can point to something that lasts, that will go on, that will form an identity that we can hold on to and won't change with time, the Buddha says that kind of identity doesn't exist, or at least we won't be able to find it. He's not actually saying it doesn't exist strictly. He's saying you can't ever find it. It might be there, but you never experience it. Because everything we experience is impermanent, is changing, is beyond our control most of the time. The only thing that's not beyond our control is the way we relate to our internal experience, but that's not our true self either. So, that is the Water Snake Sutta. It contains virtually all of the deep, or many of the deepest thoughts in the spiritual path. This, if you want to go, it's translated and on many different websites on the internet. Well worth studying. And there's also, if you're interested, at the end of class, you can ask me and I can tell you of different monks that have given talks on this subject and where you can hear more about it. So thanks for listening. And now's your time to ask any questions or any address anything you'd like. Hi, all the way in the back.